Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Eastern European Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Iva Gališić, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Iva Vukušić about her new book, Serbian Paramilitaries and the Breakup of Yugoslavia. Now, Iva is an assistant professor in international history at Utrecht University and a visiting research fellow at the Department of War Studies at King's College, London. Iva, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Really happy to have you with us today and to talk about your new book, Serbian Paramilitaries and the Breakup of Yugoslavia. And this study really examines the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s, but with a particular focus on paramilitary violence. So I'm interested if you could tell us, how did you become kind of focused or interested in this area of research?
Sure. So I was born and raised in the former Yugoslavia. I come from Zagreb, from Croatia. And while I was not directly victimized by the war, I remember it well. And I remember the turmoil, the fear, the violence, the suffering of civilians and the instability, nationalism, sort of all of that that dominated the decade and this period of me growing up. And it led me to started following the trial against Slobodan Milošević some years later. That was going on, of course, in The Hague. I was following it from afar because at the time I was working as a young journalist at Radio 101 in Zagreb. After that, I did my master's studies in Sarajevo and in Bologna in Italy in a human rights program and wrote a thesis on the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Then I continued working as an analyst and a researcher at the Special War Crimes Department of the Prosecutor's Office in Sarajevo, so in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And basically my job was to help prosecutors and investigators build cases and indict alleged perpetrators of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Then in 2009, I arrived in The Hague. I worked at the Sense News Agency, which was also based at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. The acronym that we're going to be using is the ICTY. And I followed basically all the ongoing trials for several years. So Mladic, Karadžić, and many of the other big trials. So my path, so to say, to these topics was long. And when I started my PhD in history in Utrecht, which was in 2015, I already spent a considerable amount of time and sort of, you know, effort working on perpetrators in the context of the former Yugoslavia, and paramilitaries were very much part of that story. So it made sense to write a dissertation, and that dissertation was the basis of for this book, within a broader project on paramilitarism that was led by Dr. Ungur, who is a professor now at the University of Amsterdam. And this project was focusing on paramilitaries. So I worked with other people kind of that were busy researching these kinds of actors in different contexts. And these paramilitaries, I felt, in the former Yugoslavia were a violent actor that was widely discussed in literature. So literally every book about the breakup of Yugoslavia, much journalistic reporting, talked about these units and these men, because it was mostly men, but they remained sort of poorly understood. That's how I felt. So that sort of led me to the project. And that's how this book came about.
Yeah, look, I mean, that's a very interesting approach to this topic, coming from, you know, already an experience with working with this material, and especially in the context as a journalist, and moving towards a more kind of academic focus on this area, which you rightly point out stayed on the margins of scholarship for quite a bit of time. I guess we can start with some definitions, if you don't mind. Can you tell us what is a paramilitary unit? Why do you also focus specifically on sub-paramilitaries? You note in your book that other warring parties experienced kind of some form of this paramilitary engagement. So I was wondering if you can tell us why focus on this particular group. And perhaps also if you can tell us what is the difference between Serb and Serbian terms or phrases that you use throughout your book.
Sure. So let me tackle the second half of that question first. So Serbian basically in my book refers to Serbia proper. So the Republic of Serbia, which was of course then part of Yugoslavia. When I use Serb, it refers, it's kind of a broader term, and it sort of refers to various actors in Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina. So local Serbs, not from Serbia proper. These populations lived in Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina. And basically this is an effort to make a distinction between actors that came from Serbia proper and actors that were quote-unquote local in Croatia and in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Because I feared that, especially for people that were not sort of in-depth in this topic, if I said just Serbian, they would assume that they all came from Serbia proper. And that's very much not the case. So, and in the book, I discuss it in some length because I deal with both sort of units that were affiliated with kind of the regimes, you know, in Belgrade and in Serbia, and also these kind of partners, so to say, in Croatia and Bosnia. I focused on Serbian paramilitaries not because, as you noted, other quote-unquote sides of the conflict did not have any paramilitary units, nor because I argue that they alone were the sole or quote-unquote, again, worst sort of perpetrators of violence. I talk about this choice explicitly at the beginning of my book. I focus on Serbian paramilitaries because they were most numerous and engaged in a wide variety of areas from the beginning of the war in Croatia, so in 1991, through the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which was 1992 to 1995, and then all the way to Kosovo, which is the end of the decade, 1998 and 1999. So because these units basically mobilized a larger numbers of volunteers than those on the other sides, and they just acted in a wider space for a longer time, and ultimately, because of this as well, they hurt more people. Also, another book by my colleague Kate Ferguson in the UK came out not long before I finished my dissertation, and she kind of had this broader approach, focusing on various units across different sides. So I did not want to duplicate that effort. On the definition of paramilitary units, so there are numerous potentially overlapping concepts here that scholars, practitioners, journalists, and others use to describe similar units. And we see this very much in other contexts and conflicts around the world. So militias, armed groups, non-state actors, mercenaries, you know, vigilantes, death squads, all kinds of terms are used for units that are in some way overlapping or similar. So there is no consensus on a definition. And for the purposes of my book, I decided to define them as groups of people, as I already mentioned, mostly men, who are armed, who are organized. So they have some kind of a hierarchy and a structure to them. My third sort of criteria was that they were recognizable. So they would have a name or insignia. My fourth criteria was that they were political in their goals, even if political was broadly defined and not necessarily publicly stated. And crucially, I would say, the unit at the time of establishment does not form part formally of the state apparatus. And I took the moment of establishment as a key here, because as readers of the book will note, I talk about units that through time became sort of more formalized and quote unquote sucked into the state. So some units started off as paramilitaries and then later on sort of became a part of the state apparatus. So this is the definition that I kind of invented for the purposes of my book. But again, there's no consensus. And that's also partially because these actors are so diverse and the context in which they act are so different. It's very difficult to find a definition that will work perfectly, you know, the former Yugoslavia in Sudan, in Ukraine, in Venezuela, or you know, in any other place on earth.
I think you do a really fantastic job in trying to, you know, capturing this term Serbian paramilitaries, all this complexity, because indeed, you know, paramilitaries itself is such a layered term. And your use of kind of Serbian also tell us a little bit about that relationship between the Serbian state and Serb paramilitaries and the complexity of that relationship that we'll talk about through our conversation today. Now, as a fellow historian, one of the things that I'm kind of always interested in are the archives. So I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about the materials that you used. You note in your book that you focus predominantly on the archives of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. This is an enormous archive. So tell us, what challenges do historians face working with these sources?
Right. Well, I love talking about archives. I'm very happy that you're asking me. And I'm almost on some kind of a mission to get these archives used more. So I try to talk about it to anyone who will listen. But basically, I talk about the sources extensively in my book, and these are the ICTY archives are enormous, as you already noted. So this was a court that operated for 25 years, indicted 161 people, conducted dozens of trials. Some of them were huge. Some of the trials that related to Srebrenica, for example, multiple accused, hundreds of witnesses, thousands of pieces of paper, years in the courtroom. Slobodan Milošević's trial, which of course ended without a judgment because he died, Ratko Mladić, Radovan Karadžić, and numerous other people whose names won't be recognizable to you know, anyone who's really not into it in depth. These lasted for years and included the presentation of thousands of pages of evidence. And this evidence, I think it's kind of to illustrate, these are military and intelligence reports from the field during the war, intercepted conversations, police orders, political party meeting minutes, state institution meeting minutes, local authorities documentation. Almost 5,000 witnesses testified at the ICTY, and some did so numerous times. So, for example, people who survived the killings in Srebrenica, I think there were 8 or so, maybe, if I'm not mistaken. So the executions after the fall of Srebrenica, these people testified numerous times. Insiders also provided crucial testimony. And insiders are basically people who were closely involved with the perpetration of crimes. So, you know, people who were maybe not necessarily, you know, killing people on the execution sites, but were, you know, the bus driver who took the victims to the site, or, you know, a fellow officer who was kind of implicated in the events, but was maybe not kind of directly personally involved. So these insiders provided really incredibly important evidence, because this is the type of information that outsiders wouldn't know. And maybe that is, you know, the type of information that is maybe not necessarily written down. So you don't get archives and documents that say, you know, go and murder everyone in this village, a stamp and sign. So the, you know, these insiders kind of often say the things that were unwritten, you know, say the things that don't appear necessarily explicitly in an archive. So I have a recent article that is called Archives of Mass Violence, Understanding and Using the ICTY Trial Records in a special issue of Comparative Southeast European Studies, and it's open access. So I talk about, you know, the archive and what's in it and how to use it in that piece more. But just one or two more short comments on the collection. So the archive is both enormous, but also importantly, partially inaccessible. While the archive is available online to anyone with an email address, and when I say archive, these are, you know, transcripts from court sessions, evidence material, and a bunch of other sort of documents that are created in a judicial process. That said, many important documents, confidential exhibits from trials involving, for example, sensitive state documents, remain confidential, and we don't know when and if those records will become accessible. And I am also kind of on a mission to get my fellow historians more interested in this in terms of lobbying for access to these records. It's been almost 30 years since many of them were created. The court is not kind of indebted in any way to release them. So I think there needs to be more public pressure to be like, hey, these documents are, I mean, if you know, if I'm from the former Yugoslavia, these documents are also mine. They refer to what, you know, to what we've been through as a community. So I would really like people to kind of lobby more for access to them. But, you know, still the ICTY needs to be applauded for making the evidence available, as most courts, international and domestic, do not provide this access. You know, I live in The Hague. Most of the courts here absolutely do not provide the same level of access. So I think the ICTY, or now the residual mechanism, this institution that inherited some of the work of the ICTY, it is great that they're, you know, doing this, and that historians and other researchers can really look into these archives, because there's no better collection in this world about what happened to us as former Yugoslavs. So finally, I would also say that I do not use judgments as a source in my findings. So I use primary sources. And so the court saying someone is guilty or not guilty makes absolutely no difference to me. Law operates based on other rules, and those are not relevant for historians, I think, in making their findings. And I talk about this book also in my book. And just sort of finally, I also used mostly documents written by forces, quote unquote, on the same side. So in writing about Serbian paramilitaries, I do not base my findings on documents of the, for example, Croatian intelligence service or Bosnian government's intelligence service. I use documents that were created by various Serbian forces in Serbia proper and the institutions of the kind of entities in the making, for example, Republika Srpska's army, police, etc. So I did not use quote unquote enemy documents for my findings. And I think this is also really important to note. But again, this article that I recently published would really, I think, be a good introduction to scholars that are thinking about potentially, you know, heading into this direction and using this really, really incredibly valuable collection.
Mm. Yeah, look, absolutely. Your book gives such a good impression of the stoicism, I guess, required to work through this archive, both in terms of volume, but of course, its content. And I would definitely invite our listeners to have a look at the article as well, The Archives of Mass Violence, because I think you open there a little bit of a broader perspective on sort of how do you approach this archive, noting, for example, that this is not just something that is a source for researchers and scholars, but there is a kind of benefit in opening that to much broader, not only audience, but scale of professionals, including, for example, artists from former Yugoslavia who have used this archive in various different ways to try to raise visibility of these issues in countries of former Yugoslavia. I want to move
absolutely
to,
yeah, just if I can add one more thing. Absolutely. I also think in some ways, I mean, these archives, the way I see it, are also a kind of a memorial. You know, that the fate of the people that were tortured, beaten, raped, robbed, humiliated, slapped, you know, just treated in the worst possible way, that this kind of depository is also a way to say, hey, this happened. Hey, this is not going to just be left, you know, and forgotten. And this is not to say that, of course, the archives, you know, explicitly refer to every single victim, because this is a war crimes trials archives, right? So it's if it wasn't part of the process, it's not going to appear prominently in the trials. But luckily, the trials were many, and many of the trials were also quite, you know, all-encompassing, so to say, for certain municipalities and for certain camps and for certain places of detention. Srebrenica, for example, is extremely well documented. So in some way, I think it's also a way to sort of just remember, you know, the victims of this violence.
I mean, I think that's a very good point, especially in the context where we struggle quite a bit to have visible sites and monuments to victims of the war. They're such a contested kind of piece of public art and public architecture still to this day. And I guess this is some kind of a depository that you know, it's there, it's physical, it's recorded. So that's really important. Just for us to talk a little bit about the formation of these paramilitary units. I mean, that's quite a interesting and then little known, I guess, aspect of this story. The Yugoslav People's Army was the sole official armed force of the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And now with the breakup of the country, we see kind of the sudden proliferation of unofficial, irregular paramilitary units. So I was wondering if you can tell us a bit about how these units were established, what I'm particularly interested in, who were its members? And, you note in your book, this is kind of an important point, that at the same time in Serbia, there are all these right men who are trying to avoid draft, resist. So who are these men who do, predominantly men, right, who do become members of these units?
Sure. So I think it's important to start by realizing kind of the dynamic nature of paramilitarism. So these units changed in size, in capacity, in their relationship with Belgrade's regime and local authorities. So it wasn't kind of a static, a sort of relationship and static way of being, so to say, in the contested territories. The biggest surge of mobilization was, of course, early in the war in Croatia and then BiH, so Bosnia and Herzegovina. So 1991 and 1992, this is kind of peak years in terms of numbers. Also, it's important to note that not all units were the same. So this is kind of one of my big findings, I would say, is that in literature generally and in conversations, they tended to be treated kind of in bulk, paramilitaries. But they were really set up differently, they operated differently, and ultimately also attacked civilians differently. And I discussed this at length in chapter 5 of my book. So I also tried to say something about the different violence that they tended to perpetrate. For the Serbian regime, I would say the units fulfilled sort of two key purposes, and we'll talk about that in a moment as well. But they provided plausible deniability, so to advance political, territorial, demographic goals through violence, which could be outsourced to seemingly independent actors. States do this all the time, and this is nothing new. The units also provided additional troops for the war effort, because as you mentioned, in certain urban centers, Belgrade, for example, there were actually few people willing to go to war in Croatia or Bosnia. So the regime needed troops to advance its interests. So these two things, plausible deniability and kind of boosting troop numbers, was, I would say, key. After all, after Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina became independent, as Yugoslavia disintegrated, the Yugoslav army could not legally be there anymore. And I cite in my book members who were highly placed in the regime saying, we're going to be viewed as aggressors. We need to formally get out of there. So the regime had to rely on other means to advance its interests. And sort of the what I call kind of, for the purposes of this discussion, kind of rebelled Serbs in Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina, of course, they also had their own forces, crucially paid for from Belgrade. But that was not enough. So these units provided a way for Belgrade to participate directly and without suffering kind of additional consequences for it, So these are the reasons, I think, why this regime, but also others throughout the world, tend to use these kinds of units. So the units crucially were established through cooperation. So it's really important that, one of my findings is that these units were not some like grassroots, spontaneous, popular response. These units were state supported. And without state support, they would have, dwindled in a week. So these were supported by a wide variety of actors, state and non-state, formerly non-state, kind of provided that support. The brain of the operation seems to have been the state security services from Serbia. But again, much of that documentation is still inaccessible because, of course, Serbia's interests is to not have these documents publicly available. And again, this is not something that is unique to Serbia. Many other states do that as well. But many investigative journalists also wrote about the ties between the regime, the state security, organized crime, and this kind of units. So the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the Yugoslav Army, through its weapons depots, local authorities, they all kind of worked together with tensions, of course, especially through time, in mobilizing and deploying these men. And who they were, the war crimes archives from The Hague are actually kind of limited in telling us much about the individual level because the trial is not about people's kind of personal stories. They don't ask questions like, how did you get to participate? This kind of stuff sort of episodically appeared because the trial is a focused effort. It's not like a broader effort, like, for example, a truth commission, right? Where it's more open what we would be talking about, at least theoretically. The trial is much more pointed. So these images about who these guys were, you get kind of episodically, but also I try to use other other sources, investigative journalism, and all these kinds of additional complementary sources. And then I think it's important to say they came from, of course, football fan circles. And other, for example, martial art clubs. And I talk about this in my book. I think one of the reasons why is that, you know, when you need a bunch of people to go to war, you want people who are used to use their bodies for violence. You want people who are okay with hurting other people. So football fan circles, martial arts clubs, those kinds of gathering places for young, energetic men were definitely one of the kind of human resources pools, so to say. Then former state security assets and hitmen like Arkan, for example, who's going to be well-known, Jed Koreznatovic Arkan is going to be well-known to anyone who, you know, knows anything about the war in the former Yugoslavia. So organized crime circles, then also adventurous young men, self-declared patriots, former French legionnaires, gullible young men who were peer pressured, unemployed guys, guys from the diaspora born to Serbian parents. So it was really a wide, wide mix of people. Some of them kind of more ideologically aware, more nationalists, some other ones more kind of lost, looking for some adventure, social advancement, those kinds of things. So it's very difficult to kind of say what was a typical volunteer, because I don't think there was such a thing.
Yeah, sure, of course. And that's a quite diverse group of people. And you also note in your book that the profile of these units evolves over the course of wars in Croatia and Bosnia. So what were some of the functions that these units fulfilled and how they operated and how did they change during these years of war?
Right. So I already mentioned the plausible deniability and the boosting troop numbers and sort of providing the regime with an opportunity to advance its goals through units which were not seen as under its direct control. So kind of outsourcing of violence, so to say. The levels of training varied, but often formation of units was tangled up with or kind of followed training being provided to these volunteers. So there were camps which acted kind of like nurseries, kind of like small incubators, so to say, to grow and strengthen paramilitary capacity. And then these members that were trained, if they were talented, they were themselves made trainers, commanders, and sort of shipped out to do the business that they were trained to do, right? So after the surge of numbers in 1992 and 1991, the numbers of volunteers steadily drops, kind of little by little by the end of the war in Bosnia. Some units get kind of formalized or sucked into existing semi-formal institutions of wannabe states, for example, Republika Srpska, or, you know, in the entity that the Serbs in Croatia also created, Republika Srpska Krajina. This is kind of a complex story, so you'll have to read the book about the establishment because it's a lot of actors and there's a lot of stuff going on. But the deployment of also varied significantly between Croatia and Bosnia and then Kosovo later. I think we'll mention it a little bit later in one of the later questions. But the main reason why Kosovo was different in how the units deployed was the fact that Kosovo at the time was legally part of Serbia, and that shaped the units' deployment. Basically, the Serbia and its armed forces had every right to be there. This was formally their territory, which is not the case with Croatia and Bosnia once they became independent. So with this fact, the calculation around deniability changed, and that had important effects on the ground. But I think we're going to get into it in a moment. But basically, members often moved between units. I would say that the more talented ones, the more sort of eager and well-trained that exhibited significant potential were sort of advanced towards higher value units. So there was some mobility as well between them. And there was a certain continuity and adaptability to the units as well, kind of as part of this paramilitary project. For example, the Special Operations Unit, which in Serbia would call JSO, Jedinica Specijalna Operacija, survived and even enabled the fall of Milosevic, then strengthened and in fact threatened the state itself when some of its members assassinated the post-Milosevic reformist Prime Minister Zoran Đinđić in March 2003. So there was really a lot of change through the decade, and you know the dynamics of the war shaped the units, but the units also shaped the dynamics of the war as well.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was wondering if you can maybe clarify a little bit this dynamic between the Serbian state and these entities within the Serbian state proper and the paramilitary units. In particular, this communication, like on the one hand, they are at arm's length in order to for the Serbian state to avoid accountability. On the other hand, they are supported by the state. As you know, they wouldn't exist if there was no financial support and other ways of kind of controlling those units. Do we have materials or documents that tell us about those channels of communications? How do we get a bit of a better sense of those channels, I guess?
Right. So we have several people that testified that were members of these units. There were also certain documents that were seized, logs, you know, military kind of or units logs as to where they were and what they were doing. There are also personnel files for a bunch of these guys. They formally are confidential, but recently there was a Rolling Stone article about one paramilitary member. If you just Google Rolling Stone's paramilitary Serbia, you will come to the article. It just came out a couple of months ago, and they dug up some of this information as well and kind of put it together. So there's like a digestive sort of version, so to say, of some of these documents in this source. So there, you know, some of the information comes from there. I think what we can see definitely is that there were certain practices that were implemented in order to have this connection between the regime and the units, while at the same time kind of muddying the waters for outside observers about who these units were and who was kind of standing behind them or who they quote unquote belonged to. And I call it in my book kind of the mechanics of plausible deniability. So kind of how that works. And there was a bunch of these practices that that the units employed. For example, a lot of the guys were not formally employed. They were kind of hired and paid in cash. They signed papers often with just nicknames. You know, these units did not appear in state budget and those kinds of practices. So it was quite an elaborate sort of scheme. And what I think that is, you know, is quite quite successful. And I think this is also something that other states realize, which is why they continue using these kinds of units.
Yeah, one of the things that I was reminded of is in my own work on Second World War and the sort of Soviet military during that period, is there was a prohibition allegedly on writing diaries during this period. Mm. And I'm reminding of that story, especially you note in your book one of these, you know, participants writing a diary, which is now, of course, quite an interesting source and insight into this really complex and, as you say, communication that's kind of muddied along the way purposely.
Yeah.
Now I want to move from the front line to Serbia, and of course, these paramilitary units had an impact on life in Serbia itself, on its political life, on institutions, and the society, how it operated in the 1990s and beyond. So, how is their involvement in Serbian society manifested during this period?
Right. So the paramilitary units, as you noted, through the ties to state security, organized crime, I would say they criminalized the state and in many ways hollowed it from within. So it's not like crime and, you know, state security and all of that involvement didn't exist prior to the war. It did. But it was deepened, it was spread, and you know, as I said, kind of hollowed the state from within. In the 1990s, there was a time of enhanced organized crime activity, smuggling, sanctions busting. There was much money to be made, and some of the paramilitary guys were busy making it. Sort of looting and how that wealth arrived as well to Serbia also mattered. I already mentioned their role in the fall of Milosevic with the special operations units, for example, when they didn't rise to defend him. So the JSO members, the special operations units, also assassinated Djindjic, and in a way, they arrested Serbia's democratic reform, possibly for a generation, kind of threw it off. And they also, the JSO as well, was deeply, deeply entangled and even kind of merged with a organized crime operation called the Zemun clan. So I did not focus in this book so much on this, but these paramilitaries were and remain also a cultural phenomenon. So people who were around at the time will remember, for example, the comic book about Captain Dragan's unit's Kninje, or the celebrity role Arkan and his turbo folk singer wife Ceca continued. You know, they had it and they continue to have it 20 years since Arkan was killed. The same goes for Milorad Ulemek Legija. So he was the commander of the JSO, the Special Operations Unit, and before one of Arkan's lieutenants. So this is a former legionnaire who is in jail serving multiple long sentences for, among others, killing Djindjic. These guys remain on the front pages of tabloid newspapers to this day. There is a certain fascination, a certain cultural grip these guys retain even now, you know, almost 30 years since they were important actors in this story. In some ways, it's almost like a soap opera sometimes when you look at these tabloids.
I mean, for a long time, they were their own genre, right, of publishing. Like, I think it's called criminal chronicles or something like that. There were people quite, it was like a dark fascination with this underground.
Yeah, and this is really fascinating that you have guys that have been locked up, like Legia has been locked up for, like, I don't know, 15 years now, and you probably even more, and you think to yourself, like, he, you know, he has this grip still on the kind of public imagination of what it means to be a brave, manly Serb, what is kind of a cool guy to, you know, youngsters and things like that. It's incredibly, like, what is the kind of attitude that one would emulate if you're kind of, you know, growing up and kind of, you know, growing up into kind of being a cool guy on the streets of Belgrade and things like that. It's incredible, this cultural grip that these guys still have.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's something about that secondhand memory there, the generation that didn't really witness the 1990s and the full expand of these, the impact of these units, but that these men are now becoming kind of part of a different mythology and cultural kind of landscape, as you note, which is, yeah, something to be worried about probably. Now, I want us to move to a period after the end of wars in Croatia and Bosnia, because these paramilitary units continue to play a significant role, and in particular during the series of conflicts in Kosovo. Tell us what that looks like now in the context of Kosovo. What does this paramilitary activity look like, and how does it compare to the earlier versions?
Right. So as I noted a little bit earlier, Kosovo was different because it was legally Serbia. The regime did not have to hide the unit's presence. They were by then integrated and in different ways in regular army and police units. What needed to be hidden was the civilian victims they were causing. So we have bodies of dead Albanian civilians being transported around Serbia during this period in an effort to hide bodies. Mass graves on police training grounds like Batajnica outside of Belgrade, I think 744 victims or something like that. So a massive number of dead civilians, Albanian civilians, are being buried, you know, in a police training site, and one of the reasons why that was because, of course, the perpetrators knew the training site is well protected. This is the police grounds, so, you know, journalists and others can't easily come to snoop around there. So this is, I think, an important difference with Kosovo. Also in Kosovo, the numbers are much, much smaller. They're nothing like we've seen in 1991 and 1992. So here they're kind of a smaller actor. But at the same time, they're different also because at this time, the Special Operations Unit is kind of part of the state. They're not anymore being denied. They're in fact kind of the flagship fancy elite unit that represents the state. So I think that the Kosovo is quite different from the mobilization and the deployment that we saw in Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina.
And to your kind of knowledge and of this material, are there any of the individuals or units that are operating throughout the entire period?
Well, there, I would say that the what we would call and what Filip Švarm in his excellent series, the unit Jedinica, called what we would also call the Red Berets. It's I would say that this is one entity, so to say, that has a certain thread throughout the 1990s. So from, you know, kind of 1991 early on when their training starts at the Golubic camp close to Knin, and then this universe of paramilitaries associated, affiliated, or trained by them spreads out. They act in Croatia and Bosnia, and then we see them again in Kosovo. So I would say that, but they change shape, name, affiliation. So I would say the kind of the core, the spirit of the Red Berets is something that continues throughout the decade. And the other ones are kind of on and off, and then they get reawakened and, you know, and redeployed, and then they kind of go dormant again. It's much more kind of a patchy picture, I would say.
Sure, sure. Now, your book closes with a consideration of the assassination of Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Đinđić on 12th of March 2003 in Belgrade. So we are approaching the anniversary of this event. And, you know, I remember very well that period, and that's probably one of the strongest memory of those years for most of us who were in Belgrade at that time, and the kind of deep shock that event triggered in Serbian society. And it's almost difficult to talk about it without getting really kind of reliving that moment and the extent of that shock, I guess. He was assassinated by members associated with a Serbian paramilitary unit. Tell us about the impact and the significance of this event, and perhaps if you can maybe reflect on the relevance of that event in relation to the subsequent efforts in Serbia to deal with this violent past and to engage with the ICTY processes.
Right, right. Yeah, I also remember sort of the event. I was in Zagreb at the time, and kind of the fear and the panic and the, you know, conversations that I've had with my friends in Serbia at the time. A lot can be said on this, but I already mentioned that I think the assassination of Đinđić arrested reform, real reform, in ways that continue to this day. Serbia's elites remain unable and unwilling to confront the violence and the crimes their policies unleashed in the 1990s. So sadly, they're not unique. I mean, I come from Croatia. Croatia struggles with many similar issues of its own role, of the, you know, the narrative that it has about the war. So, you know, in many states around the world, like the United States struggles with like the Civil War, you know, and why did the Civil War happen? So I think, you know, questions like this are, of course, sensitive and delicate, and people just don't want to look at themselves in the mirror and ask themselves, what was done in my name? You know, who? So, you know, in some ways, that's a struggle that is not unique to Serbia. You know, states refuse to face and condemn crimes perpetrated by their forces in their name. And I think Đinđić was busy with and on the road to addressing some of these issues, addressing some of the organized crimes grip, I mean, overtaking of the state, essentially. And that's why he was killed, because the organized crime and the guys around the Zemun clan and the guys around the Special Operations Unit and their friends and colleagues were threatened by the state reforming. They were threatened and that they felt it. And the, you know, killing Đinđić was in an effort to save themselves. They failed many, you know, many ended up in jail in the aftermath, but also many didn't. So, you know, some of the associates just got away with it. And so there was never really a true reckoning about the broader political project, what it was about, what the crimes and suffering it perpetrated and produced. There was a there's also significant denial about the crimes of the 1990s. But again, you know, Serbia sadly is not alone in this issue. So I think Djindjic was on the way to trying to, you know, fix some of that, so to say, if that's a suitable word. And then he was prevented from doing so. And no one ever after appeared with a similar plan and with a similar sort of ambition, so to say, and chances of success. When it comes to the ICTY processes, they're largely completed and tribunal closed, while a residual mechanism, this residual institution, works on the remaining tasks. So one important judgment is actually coming this year, the final trial in the case of two important defendants who were high-ranking state security officials. So that process, people who follow this will know, Stanišić and Simatović. This process is 20 years in the making, which I think also speaks to the complexity of the topic and these entanglements between state security, organized crime, and paramilitaries. This process is all about the state funding, establishing, and directing paramilitaries in Croatia and Bosnia. The attention has faded. So I live in The Hague. I was recently at the appeals argument in this trial, and like no one seems to care. While this is really one of the most important trials that we've ever had at this tribunal. So it's really a crucial case, and I'm very curious to hear what the judges will say finally. Whatever happens, the trial produced archives. Again, many of them were confidential, but the archives from this trial and many others that are available, they remain, you know, they're out there and they can be used no matter the outcome of the trials. And I really encourage scholars, especially historians and, you know, younger scholars, to use this incredibly important collection to study the violence in the former Yugoslavia. We can learn a lot about perpetrators, about mass violence, about paramilitaries, but also about transitional justice and criminal trials as a process from these records. So in some ways, the story about, you know, what happened to Serbia is a sad one, I would say, you know, with the assassination of Djindjic, you know, the current elites are very much not interested, I think, in dealing with this past. And you know, I'm pretty actually quite kind of pessimistic about kind of transitional justice.
That was actually going to be my question. Where do you see this, the future of this?
Yeah, I would say for the entire region, the best days of transitional justice for the former Yugoslavia are over. It's the case for Croatia, that's the case for Bosnia-Herzegovina, that's the case for Serbia, Kosovo, I think, as well. Whatever we saw from interest in this, you know, war crimes trials, quote unquote, what many called kind of reconciliation and all of that, I think that what we've accomplished. And I really don't think much, I don't expect we've seen the kind of the falling of the number of trials. We've seen many kind of lower level sort of investigations and stuff, pretty much nothing kind of up the chain of command. You know, it's just the institutions are sort of just failing, I would say, in many of these efforts to, you know, hold accountable people that were responsible for this at the national level. So I'm very sort of pessimistic in that regard. I think really the best days of transitional justice in the former Yugoslavia are behind us, sadly.
Eva, on that note, I want to thank you for being a guest today and for talking about your book, Serbian Paramilitaries and the Breakup of Yugoslavia. And I hope this conversation is part of, you know, effort to keep this on the record, to keep this conversation alive. We are far from fully dealing with this past, and it continues to influence our present quite profoundly. I was wondering if you can tell us a bit what are you working on at the moment?
Sure. So I've been in The Hague now for almost 14 years, and I continue following war crimes trials that are taking place at numerous institutions, for example, the International Criminal Court. I remain interested in researching perpetrators and perpetration of violence. And like many scholars and practitioners, I'm keenly following developments in Ukraine. And that's basically for two main reasons. One is that the discussion around justice for crimes in Ukraine are rapidly changing and shaping the field of accountability and judicial justice more broadly. What I've seen in the last couple of months, for example, around the discussion about an establishment potentially of another tribunal for the crime of aggression, that's really shaping the field. And that's, I think, an important reason why people should pay attention. And secondly, is the war in Ukraine has many overlaps with the former Yugoslavia. And the accountability process is already struggling in ways that are comparable to what I experienced when I worked in Bosnia. For example, the Ukrainian General Prosecutor's Office registered, I think by now, over 70,000 potential cases of war crimes. We had enormous numbers of registered war crimes that needed investigation, potential registered war crimes that needed investigation as well. So some of the ways in which Bosnia struggled in the aftermath of all of this is something that Ukraine is and will be experiencing. So I'm currently engaged in some of these conversations about what kind of institutions best serve the victims and survivors in Ukraine and how not to repeat some mistakes we made in the former Yugoslavia when seeking to fight impunity for these horrific crimes. I think the former Yugoslavia has much to say about what works and what doesn't in accountability efforts. And I hope Ukrainians and those who are supporting them take note to not repeat the same mistake, to strategize better, to explain trials and processes to the public better. So I suspect my second book will be about the efforts to achieve a measure of justice for crimes in Ukraine.
Eva, good luck for your research, and we hope to have you on our channel again with your future work. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was really a pleasure.